on this edition of the program. Will AI bring about 0% unemployment? And will the road that we take to get there be very, very, very rocky? One man is going to explain all of it. The great Andrew Main joins us. It's all coming up.
This is made possible by Bluefront and the Lenina. Owe Them Bones. Daily Tech News Show. V and Craig.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics, Politics, Politics program for Friday, May 3rd. Your old pal Justin Robert Young joining you here. This episode is going to be a little bit of a heady conversation between myself and somebody that I have known and worked with for my entire adult life, to be totally honest. If you're not familiar with Andrew Main, he's got quite the resume. Starting as but a humble cruise ship magician, he has made himself a star of A&E television with Don't Trust Andrew Main. He was down into the deep of Shark Week, where he built his own suit to detect sharks using machine learning, and went to OpenAI, where he became their first prompt engineer. It's a pretty heady resume. And that's before you get to the fact that he is a successful author of thriller novels and a lot more. I'm sure I'm forgetting stuff. He hired me at one point. So, you know, nobody's perfect. Anyway, this is our conversation with Andrew Main. In every election since I've been alive, the number one reason why people choose who to vote for is the economy. And there is a man for whom believes that the economy is at the precipice of something truly, truly interesting. Thanks to the technology of artificial intelligence. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce you to a good friend of mine and the author of a brand new article that says AI will bring about 0% unemployment. The one, the only, Andrew Main. How you doing, buddy?
Very good. Thanks for having me here, Justin.
So give me the premise of the article for folks who are not really all that well-versed on AI in general and how it will affect employment.
Okay, so the article is based upon trying to explain that if you accept certain things to be true, then other things will likely to be true too. If you accept that in some cases using AI in a business can make a business more efficient, and not saying in every place and AI is fully there yet for all roles, but if you assume that, you know, we talk about right now, people worried about losing jobs to robots and AI. Why would you lose a job to robot and AI? Because it does something cheaper, because it's just cheaper, yeah. It's cost, right? Or it does something that can't be done. So if we accept the idea that AI progressively is becoming better at doing the labor or work that humans can do, then it assumes that we're going to be adding AI into other facets of business and creating new efficiencies. Now, what happens? What happens if I use an example of a company like H&R Block. What happens if they replace all their seasonal accountants with AI? Well, one, they're not going to hire any more accountants, which is bad. But the upside is they have a lot of money, which you'd say, well, that's good for H&R Block. Well, true. But H&R Block will have to reinvest that money, or else they want to watch it depreciate over time. So they're going to take that money and they're going to put it into the market. They're going to invest. They're going to do other things. I mean, they could build, you know, Easter Island monuments themselves too, if they wanted to do that, which would be an inefficient use of capital and not really likely to get a reinvestment. And you'll get dumb things done. But that would still involve putting the money somewhere into the economy. Ideally, they'd be investing efficiently. But the point is, what happens to that money? Well, historically, what happens to money that goes into tech companies? You know, Apple has something like, they call it like a $200 billion cash hoard, but it's not really a hoard in the sense that it's a vault filled with cash. This is money that they buy securities, they buy stocks, they reinvest, they acquire other companies, they invest in other companies, et cetera. This is the pattern. Silicon Valley started from a very few companies to now Silicon Valley is arguably a major part of the global economy, disproportionately so, because of all that reinvestment. So if we assume an AI fuel economy, as you displace industries, as you do this, you're going to get a tremendous amount of reinvestment. You're going to get new companies. You could say, okay, cool, but they'll just hire AI or robots or whatever and put them in there. Well, that will be the answer. The problem is this. If you imagine that you're going to get this really high rate of economic growth, you're going to have a high rate for demand for labor. And this is where we get to the critical part of it is there will never be enough robots, never be enough computers to meet those demands. While you're waiting, while H&R Block deploys robots to take over all of their accountant jobs, you know, accounting firm, you know, Smith and Brothers wants to do this. They may not be able to hire. They may not be able to get that kind of talent. They may not be able to get the machines to do this, whatever. And they're going to run, may go extinct because they can't compete with H&R Block, or they're going to have to, in the short term, have to leverage that with hiring more accountants or hiring more stuff, or the growth that comes from other industries. If you wanted to start a new business, you're going to use AI and robots as much as you can. But if the demand is so much greater, you're going to use whatever talent you can. And this is what we've seen historically. My point is, historically, this is an argument that was made first, you know, by Adam Smith had made this, and then David Ricardo called it the comparative advantage, which is the idea that if I have a surplus or if I produce something extremely well, it makes sense for me to hire somebody, to pay somebody who maybe isn't as efficient as I am, because my efficiencies are greater than theirs. If I have 100%, you know, if I can invest $100 in my own business, then I'm going to do that and keep growing, and I'm going to outsource whatever I can when I can. You know, examples would be, it's like, you know, with, you know, you're running, Google runs a cafeteria. They outsource the cafeteria management to somebody else. They just pay somebody money to come in and run their cafeterias. Why do they do that? Why don't they run it themselves? Well, because for every person they hire to go run that is somebody they could hire at Google to help Google make more money. It doesn't make sense. Yeah. It's why you outsource a lot of things. Sometimes you insource. Sometimes eventually over time you do that. Apple is one of the largest manufacturers of consumer devices on the planet. You know, if you just take the iPhone alone, Apple doesn't own the factories where they make their phones. Apple hires Taiwanese firms or in China to build their phones. Apple may actually own the machines in the factories, but they don't want to run the factories. Why don't they want to do it? Because for every Apple exec, for every person they hire, they can either put them towards making more money for Apple directly. It's easier to just have somebody who oversees the relationships of the factories than trying to have 3,000 factory managers, et cetera. Although they found themselves in that position because trying to manage those big of factories is hard. So,
just to step back for a second. So what you're not saying that we are not about to go through a lot of upheaval in terms of the job market, of what we are going to understand the roles of the economy are, but rather what comes after that, which is something that a lot of people don't focus on. Everybody focuses on the upheaval part. They don't focus on what happens after that. You're saying that the historical precedent is expansion.
Yeah, everything, it's hard to predict what will and won't be disrupted. Some things might be more obvious than others. And I think that it's going to be continuous disruption. There's never a point where we stop and we go, we're finally at the future. That doesn't happen. You know, we continue. The future has a future. And we forget that. We think that the future is just a one specific version of today. And that's it. You know, when you write sci-fi novels, I'm always, or read sci-fi or look at movies, it's always interesting, like 50, you know, 100 years from now versus 1,000 years from now, they're kind of interchangeable. Well, that's not the reality. They're going to have the future has its own future. So what happens now? What we're seeing right now is I know people who've been involved in copywriting and writing short form copy, and they're getting replaced by AI because AI does a really effective job of copywriting. In theory, those companies are using copywriting, you know, they don't need to pay for that service anymore, and they can just take those profits, they can buy yachts, they can invest, they can do whatever they want to, but that money circulates. And so what happens to the copywriter? Well, the copywriter has to find a new job, you know, and you can either become, you know, skilled in a new way that's going to be useful, you know, or you're going to sit on the sidelines. And I would say that the skill acquisition has gotten actually easier. And that's one of the things I'm trying to explain is that when you have a high growth economy, we invest more money, not out of the goodness of our hearts, but because out of necessity to bring in people into the economy. Now, the example I use is World War II. World War II, we had a tremendous part of our labor force was fighting in Asia, it was fighting in the Pacific and fighting in Europe. And who was left home to build the machines that we needed? Who was left home to build, you know, to make boots, to build airplanes, to build this? We had women, we had older people, we had people traditionally had not been part of the economy. So what did we do? We figured out really fast how to get them into factories and train them so they could produce. Because figuring out how to get them into the labor force was more cost effective than leaving them on the outside. And that's a point I wish I could have spent more time in the article, among other things, to kind of go into, is that there's going to be a point where we see this to a certain extent, like tech companies go out of their way to try to like bring people into the country to work in tech because there's just not enough people with the right kind of experience and degrees. And you look at, you know, in certain areas, fast food restaurants and even like that, they actually offer benefits, you know, further, you know, more in places where there's labor shortages. They will go out of the way to sort of figure out, you know, perks to sort of bring people in there or how to train people or how to skill people, whatever. So, you know, there are programs that will pay for your vocational schooling now for a percentage of later on because they look at that as a strategic investment. That's going to increase. You know, if you don't want to work, well, yeah, nobody's going to make you work. But the skilling and the changing, that is the hard part. That is the challenge we have to navigate. But we have to accept the idea that we could try to protect all the jobs we have now. Yeah. India tried that in 1949. I love India, but that economic policy was not a good one.
Explain that. Because that is the other side of this is that if we understand that we are probably going into a transformation, not the first transformation in the American economy's history, but let's say at least on par, if not more acute, that there are obviously policy prescriptions that will become popular or unpopular. The protectionist side of let's tamp down AI development or let's make sure that certain jobs don't go away. That would be one side of the argument. And you cite as the historical precedent, the Raj laws of India.
License Raj. So yeah, what that was those were sort of the unofficial term to describe a lot of rules and regulations put in place to protect the Indian economy. The Indian government took a very kind of like a very post-World War II British stance, was very socialist and very protectionist. And the idea is, well, why let's not send money elsewhere to buy a thing if we can make it here. Well, one, if you can buy it cheaper elsewhere, that means your consumers are paying lower prices, right? You know, people argue we should do domestic production of everything in America. It's like, and you ask them like, well, how much do you want to pay for an iPhone? You know, do you want to pay $3,000 for an iPhone? You know, how much do you want to pay for a lot of things, even food goods, which used, you know, foreign parts, et cetera. And people don't think about that. They don't process that. They think it's the same to make it there as it is to make it here. They're just selling it cheaper for some reason. Or, well, yeah, their labor costs are lower. Okay, well, factor in those labor costs. You know, look what's happening in places that have raised minimum wage and fast food restaurants. What happens to those labor costs, right? So what happened in India was they would put in things, decisions like, hey, you know, we need to protect our textile industry. So we're going to prevent, you know, we're going to prevent the industrialization of textiles because look at all these people who work in textiles and they've done it for generations, for hundreds of years. They wanted to protect that, you know, that, you know, for those people, which maybe seemed like a great idea on the surface. But what happened was by preventing the importation of textile machines, preventing investment that would likely cause, you know, a real textile industry to develop there and continuing to make things by hand, they were right. The children and the grandchildren of those people working in textiles continued to work by hand, making textiles, making very little money a day, while over there in Hong Kong, which started to have its own sort of economic independence around the same time, thrived, you know, while young Indians were growing up to go work outside, you know, weaving textiles by hand and basically making a few cents a day in Hong Kong. Their wages were measured in dollars and tens of dollars, et cetera, and their life expectancy and all those other benefits happened from that. And so you basically made generation after generation suffer because of this. And you see that effect. And say India's changed. India's changed a lot in the last few years. They've actually, you know, been more open to investment, more open to bringing outside companies in and doing that. And there's a big positive change there. And you can see the effects of that. But historically, they were on a point where, you know, they were richer than China at one point. And then China in economic, average incomes eclipsed them. And what was the difference? And it was, you know, a lot of factors that it came down to is the willingness to basically industrialize, et cetera. So if you employ protections, understand if you think that there are problems in this world, the way you solve problems is through efficiencies. You want lower healthcare, you figure out how to lower priced healthcare, you figure out how to make it cheaper. You want lower priced goods, you figure out how to make them cheaper. If you say, well, no, we're not going to make these things cheaper, we're not going to do this, we're going to protect these things, well, then you will. And you're going to be limited by progress and not have the outcomes you want.
I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit. Obviously, we've been friends for a very long time. I was privileged enough to help you with the writing of this and help shape some of the arguments by the time that it wound up getting to the final print. And I loved the concept of it from the very, very beginning, because it feels like there is just a lot of doom that comes along with the concept of AI. And while I can understand that anything that has the power to change things as rapidly as AI does have will come with instability, and instability brings about anxiety, it seems odd to me that we don't have the same kind of, at least in the mainstream, glowing optimism that we had with the internet, that me and mm-hmm. you have been friends for long enough that the nascent days of the internet and blogging were something that we talked about with all of the possibilities of what could happen. And obviously there is a subsection of that, but it seems like there is at least in our mainstream media, however we define that these days, it's a bit of a doomer mentality. And I was excited for you to make an argument on the other side of it. Why do you think that there is a negativity about AI specifically?
So part of the problem, and one of the reasons I decided to write this and be more vocal about this, there are people I work with and people I respect in AI who are generally positive that the overall outcome of AI will be great. But their assumption is the future doesn't need us, that we'll have to invent mechanisms for the future to keep us around, universal basic incomes, things like this. Because their assumption is AI is going to be so great at everything, we're going to use AI for everything, there's going to be no jobs left for people. And I, you know, first I said, well, that's kind of a concerning thing. But then I thought through it, like, well, if I accept the idea that we're going to put AI into everything, then we're going to have growth. And what we know about growth, high growth, is it always outstrips supply. And if that's the case, then the future will really need us. We'll need us more and more. Our value will increase. And if, you know, that appeals to me, was certainly an emotional reason, but that's not a reason for me to accept that argument as acceptable. I think the problem we get sort of this doom is there's either the doom that, hey, AI is going to take over. AI is going to get rid of people and it's going to suck. Or AI is going to have a weird, crazy Skynet scenario. That's by the people, you know, kind of the fear of AI. Then the AI optimists have a vision that to me isn't that optimistic if you really think about it. And that is, yeah, AI will do all our work and we won't need to work anymore. I'm like, well, as a guy who comes from a family of people that never retire because we like to work, that's a terrifying idea. Yeah. And when I know that even on a very basic primate level, we know we need to have purpose. If we do not have purpose, and it can't just be self-determined purpose today, I will do this. It has to be mission, it has to be this. It has to have, you know, a lot of other factors play into it. We lose, you know, sight of this. I have a fear of, you know, of a dystopia where everybody has what they want, but we're in, you know, we're just slowly destroying ourselves in strip malls and, you know, with weird drugs and new highs and new stuff like this, because we don't have a sense of value. Everything we do is fake.
Name one stretch of a year and a half where that was tested in America.
Yeah. Well, I was certainly, I think that absolutely is true. Is, you know, during the pandemic is that when you started subsidizing people and you started, you know, saying, hey, you know, some sectors of the economy, whatever. And there are a lot of different lessons to be taken from there. And you know, there's been experiments in UBI, which are encouraging, but a lot of what they do in the UBI isn't, those experiments are generally aren't, we're going to make it so you never, ever have to work again, whatever. The one, these things are usually time constraint. Like for the next 2 years, you can do this. Next thing you do this. And also it's often going into places and saying really a safety net. They're safety net experiments to say, hey, if we take care of your healthcare and your house and whatever, so you're not stressing day to day about what you're going to do, can you get off your feet? Well, yeah, that sounds the same thing as I would do for a friend that was struggling to say, hey, here's my couch. Yeah. You know, let me give you gas money, go out there and get back on your feet. And so part of it is trying to separate those. But yeah, the point is that even the people, the most positive scenarios of the, and you never work again, if you really think through, that's scary. That's scary. You know, and I like the option. You can say like, yeah, retire at 22. That's fine. I think if you want to just opt out, cool. But I think the future will want you and need you.
One of the other reasons that I think culturally leads to some of the doomerism, at least in the mainstream, is the idea that we've lived in a world of constant next big things for decades now. And especially over the last decade, we've seen a lot sort of come and go with massive hype, crypto, the meta sphere and AR and VR probably among them. people get excited and then, you know, either a bubble bursts or the hype fades, the VC money goes away and we're just kind of left to a place that was closer to where we were before. AI obviously has shown up like a wrecking ball in a lot of ways over the last several years. Why is it different?
You have to understand the different kinds of hype bubbles. There's hype bubbles that are spawned by people's excitement for the potential of a thing. And there are hype bubbles that are spawned by people's excitement because the use of a thing. Okay. The difference between internet and crypto. Why were people getting hyped up? And again, and there was an investment bubble pop in the internet, but there was not an internet bubble. Internet usage continued to increase throughout the bubble. And that's the thing you have to separate.
The late 90s when there was the pets.com bubble that exploded.
Yeah, in the early 2000s when you had the 2002. Yeah, you had the pop or the investment bubble and they lost the crashes, right? So, but it wasn't like if you went to go look at metered internet usage, you saw that it continued. Pages visited, that continued. What happened was there were a lot of bets that were made. They realized were really bad bets because they thought they saw the future in a certain way. And many of those investments were made. Those companies were invested in several years before we really had a good idea of what people were going to be doing. And it was highly speculative. But clearly, if you had a portfolio of, let's say, you know, a broad group of investments, many would have failed, but you still would have succeeded in the longer term by the ones that did stay around. So that was hype based upon people actually using a thing that never slowed down. Crypto, on the other hand, separating the idealistic versions of crypto and blockchain, what was crypto? Crypto was this idea that we're all going to transition to this crypto economy and the economy is going to move there. Okay. That was the idea. That was the pitch. That was why, you know, you invest in these things and do that. What was the reality? What was crypto technology being used for? Gambling, buying drugs, buying NFTs. That's it. That is literally the majority of utility of this thing was for gambling, you know, speculation, and then, you know, illicit activities. And somebody, if you disagree with me, please show me your data to show me what was going on beyond that. It wasn't performing. The original idea was a very noble idea, which is, you know, you have people in unstable economic situations where they can't trust the government, but, you know, banks, all this, you don't have to argue that to me, but we never lowered the cost of microtransactions. You know, the gas fees, things like this were ridiculously expensive. There wasn't really a great microtransaction system that was easy to use or built, whatever, because the real money was getting other people to kind of jump in on Ponzi schemes and do that. And so I'd say that was a thing, like if we ripped away crypto from right now, like how would it negatively impact things right now? Well, it'd be harder to gamble. It'd be harder to buy drugs. Yep. It'd be harder to, you know, spend your money on NFTs and stuff. I think there's a future for crypto. I absolutely believe there's a great future for it when it actually performs utility. So you look at the internet and you go look at AI. If you don't use AI, if you're not using ChatGPT or Claude or any of these other models on a daily basis and people just tell you about it, your perception is very different. You're thinking, oh, somebody's just asking it a stupid question to go to Google. That's what you think that it is. And so from your point of view, it would look like, it's a CB radio. You know, it's a hype. It's not a thing. When I use it, I use a couple different AI engines when I code, and I can't just use the regular like ChatGPT interfaces because my queries are much bigger and way more frequent. I spend as much as $50 a day paying for AI because of how useful it is to me, right? And there are many other people like that. And so you look at, you know, OpenAI's has predicted that their run rate is going to be is like at $2 billion. Anthropic says they're at closing in on $850 million per year. And these are things that have accelerated. This is the money they're making from companies that are actually spending on these tools and expanding on that. That means you're getting growth from utility. It's not coming from speculation.
Yes.
And I'll give you an example why. If I can for a moment, like, and sort of like, you have to think about this. If you have a social media company, let's say, hey, Snapchat, when Snapchat launched and first came out, it had really high growth, had really high adoption rate among teenagers. And they get ready for the IPO because all of a sudden they decide we're going to, you know, doing ads, and they're making a ton of money on ads. They're making a ton of money on ads. They go to their IPO, they launch, and then the company just sort of stagnates. It doesn't really change much over time. Twitter had a similar thing that happened. And you're like, well, what happened? It's like, well, when they sold those ads to companies, the ad buyers were speculating that this would be a really high rate of return. They paid yes. really high prices for this because when you in advertising, a certain sector of your ad budget, you spend on speculative advertising. You don't know what the return's going to be.
And also at that point, we were in the midst of a gigantic ad diaspora. We had yeah. newspapers dying. We had television yep. audiences declining. So there was more of a desire to speculate. There was more money behind it than there would have been otherwise because everybody was looking for the next big thing.
Yeah. And then the reality was that for dollars spent on Snapchat really wasn't giving you that high rate of return. And so Snapchat had to do some growth, do some other things to increase that, but Snapchat's values remained steady. So that was a case of like a speculative bubble of you can see that within smaller like social media companies. Social media companies often will launch and they think that they're going to just have this big growth curve, but they don't realize that the people buying ads for them are going to look 6 months, a year from now, 18 months from now, and evaluate the performance of those ads and then adjusted that, you know, downwards or most likely the case for that. So when you start to look at bubbles, you have to sort of evaluate like our hype, you know, what is it based on? Is it based upon the idea? Is it whatever? You know, I have, you know, my favorite, you know, talking point right now is the Apple Vision Pro here, right?
Yes. Which for audio listeners, yes. Please go ahead on YouTube and watch the interview with Andrew. We'll get to why that is important to AI in a second, but he is holding up his Apple yeah. Vision Pro.
One, and that's a case where we went through this with VR and AR. People invested and there was a big investment in their earlier sort of aughts on AR and VR because we finally had the point where you could take a cell phone processor, power two screens or a large screen with your stereoscopic display, you could get a usable 3D experience using, you know, available hardware, right? And people thought this is about to take off. But it wasn't like we were watching people use it and investing in it. It was the technology seemed ready. We were primed for this idea through, you know, 50 years of TV and films talking about this idea. And we saw the first form of it. And so we invested a lot of money in this thing, but there was no, other than we thought it's a cool idea, there was no track record. There was no history of, yeah, no, people are using this. People are deploying it, whatever. We found a couple of years in, people weren't deploying it. And so when Apple came out with the Apple Vision Pro, there was a lot of skepticism. You know, not they couldn't get game studios. People, nobody was really ready to jump in and then do that because the previous hype bubble. Where AI, you know, we're 4 years in now to the world of GPT, you know, 4 years since GPT-3 launched. And is it slowing down? I don't think so.
This is your update brought to you by TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That's where you need to go if you would like to get two bonus episodes each and every week. One on Monday, one on Thursday. Friends, at this time of year, you just need it because some of these things slip through the cracks. And if it ain't happening when we do the Wednesday show, if it ain't happening when we do the Friday show, then, well, friends, it just doesn't happen unless you head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com, get on that $3 level, get two bonus episodes. It is how we keep things rolling here in the Young household. And now, here are the stories that we didn't get a chance to get to while we were talking about AI. Donald Trump is set to address the Libertarian National Convention on May 23rd in Washington, D.C., a first for a former U.S. president. The Libertarian Party traditionally has been critical of Donald Trump's policies. Yeah, because they're a rival party that aims to get people to cast their one vote for their candidates and not Republican candidates. Interesting. The invitation comes amid internal changes within the LP, notably the rise of the right-wing Mises Caucus, which has shifted the party's direction since it gained control in 2022. The Mises Caucus ascent to the Libertarian Party was fueled by dissatisfaction with past nominees and a desire to capitalize on anti-establishment sentiments, particularly those amplified by COVID-19 restrictions. The LP has struggled with its identity, and that is saying it mildly. Moving from a party that once nominated a moderate former GOP governor to embracing figures like RFK Jr. They are now appealing to voters disillusioned with mainstream political options. Trump's presence at the convention is expected to spotlight the LP significantly, but also intensifies divisions within the party. Some see strategic value in his participation, including comedian Dave Smith, somebody that many thought would get the nomination for president. But former LP chairman Nicholas Sarwark has criticized the invitation as a departure from libertarian principles, pointing to Trump's policy inclinations that conflict with libertarian stances on things like tariffs, immigration, and state interventions. I have not been muted on this issue. In fact, I found out about it while I was live on stream, and I said that it was the biggest act of political cuckoldry that I can remember. And I hold by that statement. If you have the ballot access that the Libertarian Party has, which they do, RFK Jr.'s scrambling for it. The No Labels movement was desperately trying anything that they could do to get it. Having that kind of ballot access is powerful. If you are going to honor that, then in my opinion, friends, you have to take a candidate seriously. You have to use your convention to build a star that as many people within your party can vote for and that can possibly bring some people off the bench that wouldn't normally vote for a libertarian. And this is a election where you have a lot of double haters. People who don't like Trump, don't like Biden. Seemed to be a pretty good year for the Libertarian Party. But no, they've decided to gain relevance. Gain relevance by having essentially a Trump rally at their convention. Maybe it's just talking about the Libertarian Party that makes me talk like John Stossel. After all, he's been covering libertarian issues for years. I think this is a colossal misstep. It just fundamentally reshapes what the Libertarian Party is. In fact, you could make the argument that Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk's outfit, is going to do more to harm the electoral chances of Donald Trump than the Libertarian Party, a rival party that succeeds as it takes away votes traditionally from the right side of the spectrum. Because Turning Point is doing things like trying to sow fear and dissent about mail-in balloting, a pathway that Republicans have, when they win, used very effectively. They are doing more harm to the Republican cause than the Libertarians are. And Turning Point is theoretically there to elect Republicans, and the Libertarian Party is there to elect Libertarians. I don't understand it. I stand by it. It is capital C, cuckoldry. The Libertarian Party and its leadership is really, really, really excited to watch Donnie the Bull have his way with their audience. Sad times for the Libertarians. President Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. recently celebrated the significant foreign policy achievement of $60 billion in aid for Ukraine, marking a robust commitment in supporting the war effort. But moving forward, you might expect to hear a little bit less. The Biden administration intends to shift its focus away from Ukraine and concentrate more on domestic and economic concerns, which are more pressing to American voters. The strategic pivot reflects an understanding within the White House and Biden's campaign team that while the support for Ukraine aligns with promoting democratic values globally, it may not resonate urgently with the electorate. While the administration is reducing its public emphasis on Ukraine, it does face challenges in maintaining broad domestic support for the war. Experts and analysts caution that downplaying the significance of U.S. involvement could risk diminishing public understanding of the stakes involved and potentially impact future funding and strategic positioning. In contrast, the Biden team is aiming to balance its internal commitment with a campaign focus on economic issues, portraying Biden as a competent leader capable of managing multiple critical issues. As election season approaches, Biden is expected to use significant events like the upcoming NATO summit, the D-Day anniversary in France, to subtly reinforce the importance of U.S. leadership in global domestic stability while centering his messaging on everything that happens here in the good old U.S. of A. Joe Biden doesn't have a lot going well domestically. In fact, the thing that he wants and I think should talk about the most is something that is going bad that he can't fix. That's abortion. Now he says, hey, vote for me and we'll restore Roe. I have been public that I don't exactly see how he does it. They need 60 votes in the Senate. It's a very challenging map. I don't think an off-year election is going to necessarily do much more for it, but they are pushing the idea that Roe matters so much. It is so important that people will vote for it no matter what. Okay. Understood. I just don't. I don't get it. Now, here's the Ukraine problem. I think Ukraine is actually popular with the people that he needs to vote, the Nikki Haley voters. And it is the one thing in his foreign policy that he saw coming. Didn't see Afghanistan coming. Certainly didn't see Gaza coming. He saw Ukraine coming. Now, we can debate on whether or not that is a good or bad thing that he saw it coming and nothing happened other than them warning the world that a thing was going to happen. Like they were a passerby. Seems to be something that happens a lot with this State Department. You know, the same State Department, the same Secretary of State who's in Israel right now begging Hamas to sign a treaty. Hamas. We're just appealing to the better angels of Hamas's nature. Okay. Interesting. But Ukraine still represents something that, you know, taps into almost this George W. Bush coalition. So if he wants to ratchet down the focus on it, I can understand why. But I wonder if it's a wise move. Finally, North Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is defending her decision to euthanize, I'm putting in scare quotes here, her aggressive dog Cricket in light of scrutiny stemming from an anecdote in her forthcoming book. On Fox News' Hannity program, Noem described Cricket, a 14-month-old German wire-haired pointer, as extremely dangerous, recounting an incident where the dog attacked her and killed livestock. The decision, she explained, was driven by the need to protect her children and others from potential harm. The revelation came from an advanced copy of her book obtained by The Guardian, which detailed the act of taking the dog to a gravel pit on her property to perform the euthanasia at the barrel of a gun. The story has ignited a storm of controversy and political backlash, particularly from Democratic governors who criticized Noem for posting picture with their pets in a non-threatening context. The personal episode has broader political implications for Noem, once considered a potential vice presidential candidate alongside former President Trump. The incident not only raises ethical and emotional concerns, but draws parallels to past political gaffes on the presidential stage, including Mitt Romney strapping his dog to the top of the car, which we thought was dangerous in 2012, and now seems like quite a treat if the other option is a trip to the gravel pit. Here's the biggest problem. Kristi Noem, your editor hates you. Whoever edited the book, they hate you. Send them to the gravel pit. Not really. But anybody who allowed you to put that in the book, they don't like you. They just don't. I'm sorry. You can't be shooting dogs. You can't. If you are shooting a dog in your book, and these are the books that you are putting out on purpose to make you look cool, make you look good. If you are doing that, then you need so much blood that comes beforehand. You need the dog to have bit your child's arm off. You need something that really justifies it. And even then, probably keep it out of the book. Probably. Because you want to know what people don't like to think about? Dead dogs. The voters that Donald Trump needs to win are suburban Nikki Haley voters. These are dog moms. They are dog in avatar people. I don't know who thought that was a good idea, but anybody who did, boy, are they stupid. And considering it's possibly Kristi Noem herself, well, tells you what you need to know about her decision making. She's also been a little sweaty in like a little sweaty grabby in that VP slot. Donald Trump needs somebody. Mike Pence was the ideal VP for him up until the end. He was neither seen nor heard. He just said, "I agree, Mr. President." Which makes me think Tim Scott. Maybe Elise Stefanik. She's been good about lying back in the cut, just waiting. That's your update. TakePoliticsSeriously.com is where you need to go. Two bonus episodes each and every week for $3, man. Price of a cup of coffee. And it is inflation resistant. We ain't up in the price. No. $3. Come on. Head on over there. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. It's not slowing down. It's going a lot faster. And you're seeing the development not only of the ChatGPT line of models from OpenAI, but also a lot of really capable models from a lot of different people with a lot of different players. And that's with probably the company that should, by all metrics, be leading this competition, Google, that has all the money in the world, all in the engineering talent in the world, and had a head start in the technology. They're probably underperforming based on at least my vantage point here. This is something that is here now. And the reason why I mentioned for people to watch this on YouTube is because this show is a YouTube show because of AI. Because Riverside, the company that I use to record these, elevated its product from beyond just being a double-ended Zoom replacement, which is what it was before when I first used it. And they've done a great job implementing things on the back end using AI transcription and a smart editing that is all machine learning that has now been supercharged, because a lot of these models aren't just capable, they're cheap and getting cheaper. And that's the biggest thing that I believe in your version of reality that you laid out in Reason, is that this can't help but go fast and redefine things. Anything that is this good and this cheap, it's just going to change the game. And the only time that we have seen anything like this has been the internet.
Yeah, I bring up two examples in our lifetime, for sure. I bring up two examples of trying to make the point. One is that, we're very bad at imagining the future. I didn't spend any time kind of going into future jobs. And I got some criticism like, oh, what are they going to be in the future? Like, I don't know. No. And no, anybody who confidently tells you, don't trust them, you know, because yeah. We don't know. We can look at patterns, historic patterns. And one of the things I point out was, you know, 200 years ago, you know, over 80% of the economy worked on a farm, not just in agriculture, worked on a farm. Yeah. If you said, hey, 200 years from now, only 1% of the people here will actually work on a farm, you would be like, oh my God, what are we going to do with all the other people? What's
going to happen? They're in the streets. Yeah.
this is going to be horrible. And you're like, no, actually the jobs are leaving for to a job will all be better than working on a farm, unless you really like farming. Yeah. And that's hard to conceive of. And I use the example of talking about, I think it was like 1837, when Daguerre, one of the inventors of the photograph, took the first photograph of a person. Because at that point, you had to set a camera in one place, let the exposure go for several minutes because the chemicals on the film took forever to react. Set it on a still, looked out on a window on a street scene, let it go. And then he went back into his dark room, developed the photo and looked, and he saw a man getting his shoe shined. It was two people there. They stood there long enough. There are other people in the photograph you can't see because they walked by and their streaks were faint. They didn't walk enough, you know, spend enough time to register. If you said to somebody in 1837, you know, one, they might go, well, that sucks. That's not going to get better. I'm like, well, we're going to have portraits of all the leaders of Europe and America in two decades. You know, we're going to know what they look like now. Yeah. People today, we know what Lincoln looked like because he had his photograph taken, right? You know, so, but also like, yeah, this is going to get better. And then you'd be like, oh, shoot. Well, there goes being an artist. Sucks. Time to hang up, you know, my artist cap and move on to something else. And I use the explanation like, hey, listen. And imagine a future where an artist by the name of James Cameron gets to take an evolution of this, where we take this and we show you 24 of these or 60 of these per second and create a motion picture, like being able to watch a play, recorded play, be like, ah, very cool, interesting. Okay. Not only that, you know, when he goes to make said play, his budget is going to be equal in today's dollars, not adjusted, but in today's $1837 dollars is going to be equal to the budget for the entire United States Army. That is how much money he will have to spend on that. His return will be greater than the United States GNP, and he will have about half as many people working in his film as are in the U.S. Army. It'll be thousands, and the credits will be 15 minutes long for all the people that worked on that. And that's the one thing I say is you can think about scale. I will say this here, like we have a friend, mutual friend, and I wanted to play a prank on this friend, and I don't think he's listening to the show. So I'll say this is we both like Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, the musical, right? So yes. I decided last night in between things, I made Time Machine, the musical, a site that alleges to be the 1983 attempt to make a version of this. I had ChatGPT have me write it. I used Udio to create the audio. I've got four sample songs and everything. I created an elaborate version of a musical that never existed as a whim. It only took me like an hour or two in between doing other things. And like you think about like, because I'm like, oh man, I could actually do this album that never existed, you know, and have it be really good and do things. And that's the thing we think about is like, we do our Weird Things podcast. You know, we might do a thing where at the end of every Weird Things podcast, we might just have an AI write a song about it. You know, now we could have done that where we had the budget of a late show or TV show, but we don't, but we use AI and all of a sudden we can add these things. Sort of like you said with here, your show, your production value increases. What will your show look like in 4 years from now? And people are going to want to watch you, you know, they're not going to say, well, no, we're going to all watch robots. Like for some stuff. But
yeah, I mean, we're at the probably even like pre-hamster dance phase of testing this technology. Like we are just figuring out how and why it's good. And what's important from my perspective is that the tools are just showing up really fast. Yes. And we are figuring out where they are going to be beneficial. We've had the opportunity to talk to a few people as consultants for, you know, journalism and stuff and trying to help them figure out stuff. And the biggest thing that I've realized is that AI did not change what I did. It changed how I did it. Mm-hmm. It made me do it faster and it made me do it better. And that, yes, there will be jobs that will be displaced by this in the same way that we displace jobs with the typewriter and we displace jobs with, you know, television screens and stuff like that. That being said, that created new jobs and everybody who was doing a version of that job before now had the opportunity to become a lot more efficient and create a lot more and be a lot more productive. And that's the only thing that I found diving in face first with this is that, yes, we can get hung up on the evolution of the product and ignore the fact that AI has been more proof positive in what it can do than any of these other hype bubbles that we talked about previous. Or we can say, holy crap, does this thing transcribe audio really fast, really effectively? Oh my God, if you marry it to a video, a web video editing software, the idea that I would be using Riverside as a web interface, a web backend interface as my primary method of editing, that it wouldn't require a standalone program and it'd be more efficient than any of the top of the line standalone programs. Now I'm sure they'll all be, you know, far different a year from now, but that's my point. Everything, the tide is going to rise on all of this and it is happening really, really, really fast. And it seems like if I become more efficient and I can streamline what I do, I have more money. The natural thing that I want to do is to continue to invest it, expand the product line so I can continue to make more money. Yeah. And that means more jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's these things and you elevate the production quality, you entertain your audience more, you, and you know, the people that you're going to be competing with you know, our streaming services. And that's the thing that I think that if we're going to see a movement, it's going to be, and we've seen that already, where smaller independent creators are now taking collectively audience share from bigger conglomerates. And, you know, why is that? Well, platform, ability to create, ability to address niches, things like this. So that's, these are things that are just going to accelerate. But the key thing, my key thing is like the takeaway of everybody think is like, the way that we have to make this work, though, is we have to be able to learn how to learn new skills. We have to make it easier for people to learn new skills, because it's not like it just happens. Like, yeah, I think there will be effort made, put in there to make it easier. When we look at the data on job retraining, it's a very mixed bag. And some people are very pessimistic. So they go like, job retraining doesn't work. Well, what they mean is when they create a program for job retraining, a large number of people choose not to learn a new skill, because what they're saying is, well, when you have the option between learning a new job or going on a safety net, and particularly if you're after an age of like 50 or whatever, you'll just go on the safety net. You'll just retire early, so to speak. And it's like, yeah, that's a case. If you're younger and you're once you transition, you do that. We retrain all the time. You do not have the same job that you had when you left college, you know, and people will go, and I get in this argument sometimes with labor economists, like, oh, well, job retraining doesn't work. I'm like, is this the job that you had when you were 18, you know, when you got out of, you know, when you became an adult? Like, no, what happened? You went from one job, learned skills, or even you went into the company and you shifted from there. Job retraining absolutely works. It's why we're able to move within companies, and we're able to move from what we did at 20 to what we do at 30 and what we do at 40. Changing, radically changing industries can be hard later on in life. And the older you get, it gets progressively harder. But, you know, my argument is like, you don't take, you know, somebody who worked an assembly line and say, congratulations, you're now a factory worker. Like, no, maybe they do HVAC repair. You know, maybe they do something that's very adjacent to what they did. And literally in the actual skill itself, they'll say, oh, well, we'll put him from, you know, one industry that's very much like it. Yeah, but if the job itself is different, like if I worked in a coal mine and say, oh, well, I could be, you know, do consumer relations for an oil company. Like, well, it's a very different job, you know, and I think that that's, you sometimes realize a lot of labor economists have not really worked jobs too. But anyhow.
Yeah, but I mean, but you know, what my guess is, and again, I would encourage folks to listen to Andrew when he says, beware anybody who has really, really strong opinions of exactly what is going to happen in the future when it comes to how AI will reshape the economy, because there's, we are all guessing. Some might be more educated than others, but everybody is guessing. My guess is that what we see is a further diffusion of all of the industries that we have, and that we see a greater specialization in a lot of these fields. Like, I just did my taxes. I hate doing my taxes. Nothing brings about more existential dread and fear than me doing my books every year. And so a friend of ours suggested to me a bookkeeping service. So I went to go, you know, talk to him today. And I was mostly, they were like, oh, well, we can do your taxes too. And I'm like, I don't need you to do my taxes. Mostly because in my head, I'm like, you know, if I have all my numbers right, I hope that by next year I can just plug this into an AI service and it'll spit out the right forms. I just, what I really need is somebody to be looking over my stuff as I spend it, to be telling me this is good, this is a good deduction, this is not a good deduction. That's what I really need. And so that's what I'm paying for. And so I was thinking that while we're talking, well, how long until they get replaced with a computer? To which I'm like, I don't know if I want that. If I'm spending the money right now, I want a person to be using a computer to do all this stuff, but I also want them to have I don't know. I want a user interface. I am happy to pay money to know that there is something between me and the computer.
I agree. And I think that's one thing we forget is that, like I don't use an accountant. Maybe I should. I do my own taxes, which people say, why do you do that? I'm like, well, by the time I get all my records in order and everything put together, I know what I owe, you know, like I know. And I had historically bad luck with recommendations that I thankfully did not act on, going back to being 18 to somebody said, oh, you so-and-so's dad. And then I talked to them and I realized this guy helps people cheat on their taxes, which I did not want to use. And then, you know, somebody else said, hey, you should use my account and they're great. And then like 2 years later, hey, what's the matter? Oh, my accountant didn't report this, whatever, I owe $40,000. Another one. yeah, use my account. They're really good. 2 years later, I can't get hold of them. They fled the country. That happened. Like, literally, yeah. You know the people I'm talking about, too. And I'm like, well.
I do.
Andrew's learned a lesson. Do your own taxes, because.
DTA. Don't trust anyone.
Yeah, exactly. So I would love to, and I would rather, those experiences are atypical. No offense to the tax preparations world, whatever, like that. Those are atypical. Point is, I see a certain world where instead of paying somebody $100 the end of the year to handle your taxes, you pay them $500 to do your taxes, to handle your investments, to do all this other stuff when they're on the phone to explain something to you. Because by doing that, at the end of the year, you're going to have $5,000 more than you had before. And that's going to be a person running a bunch of AIs that explains to you what they're doing, that tells you, like, yeah, we put this over here, we do this. Maybe they're reading a script. I don't know. But I think that there's going to be a case for a lot more personalized services where smaller people, you know, can go in and can handle a larger number of clients and be able to offer that. I can't wait for AI to just take over healthcare. Like, if I want to go into the clinic and be greeted by the robot and never see a human.
We got into this on We're Not Wrong last week, that I cannot wait. I mean, number one, it's already replaced a lot of healthcare for me personally, because if there is a large language model that has ingested most medical data, that I can just ask a random question, and you've replaced the SEO hell that is the concept of trying to look up medical data on the web as we understand it now via search bots. It can just be something that I look up. It can source things for me. I could then look up the original stuff if I want. And then the only time that I see a human is they're a vending machine, because right now legally they have to be a human to hand me a piece of medication. That's great. I mean, I had a situation. Oh, I can talk about it now, but when my wife and I were thinking about having a kid, we went and did a bunch of tests, and she did some genetic tests and I did a fertility test. But instead of going to a doctor, I just Googled a lab, got my fertility test. They're like, hey, look, we just do the test. We hand you a piece of paper. We're not legally allowed to tell you anything. I'm like, say no more. I got the piece of paper. I took a picture of it. I asked ChatGPT to please tell me the results of this lab test in the voice of a Southern doctor. And boy, did it foghorn leghorn a positive fertility test for me. And that was I probably should not be uploading my own personal medical information to OpenAI servers. But that being said, the utility was beyond compare. Yeah. And a 24/7 non-judgmental, never tired interaction with any question you have about your health. I mean, man, that is something that I think is intensely valuable. And it breaks us out of this very shamanistic culture with healthcare professionals.
Yeah. The challenge is that I still work in how I formulate the example, because it first started when people would talk about, like, you know, like in film production, somebody be like, oh, you should hire my brother-in-law, they do this. How do I know they're good? Oh, they're great. Well, how many people do you know? Hire him as a DP. How many DPs do you know? Oh, just him. Well, how do you know he's good? like you have no idea, yeah. Right? Doctors are the same way. You know, we've only had maybe 4 or 5 doctors or GPs in our whole life. How do we know he's good? I went through this with a dentist. I was going to see a dentist and a couple, and they were super, super nice people. And it took me 2 years to realize they were incompetent, you know, and it was just one of these things where, like, I was going through, long story short, you know, spending a month on painkillers, which I do not like, do not want to be on, and finding out that, you know, what I went in and said, I think I have an abscess. And like, no, it's your wisdom teeth. Got my wisdom teeth pulled, all that, still in pain, whatever, still felt like an abscess. Went in, so the abscess, no, it's not. And they're like, well, I guess we could look below the root. Like, oh, look, there's an abscess. Wisdom teeth pulled, month on painkillers. Because it was just, and we all have stories like that or whatever. And I'm like, and so you don't know how bad somebody is. Like, you don't know if you're going to the worst doctor in the hospital or the best doctor. You often don't know. And you don't know if you're the worst dentist or the best dentist, because even the people going to get care don't know. Like, I go see them. It's like chiropractic, you know, I see my chiropractic every month. Like, is that good? Cause most people don't have to go get their backs adjusted every month, you know.
Every month. Yeah. Normally, medicine is something where you get better and then you don't need to go back in the same way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there is an abstraction And I don't know, obviously, as listeners can tell, Andrew and I could probably talk about this kind of stuff for the next 7 hours. And we probably will. We're going to end this and get on the phone and do exactly that. But part of the reason why is because there is an abstraction of knowledge that is going to radically reshape a lot of things. And I do think that they will be for the better. And while there will be a change in how people will make a living, I don't know if it's going to be this generation. Like, I have a friend of mine is a lawyer. This was about a year ago. I was telling him, I was like, hey, look, he was talking about client outreach calls. And I'm like, give me the details of a client and I'm going to enter that into ChatGPT-4 had just come out. I'm going to enter that into ChatGPT-4 and you tell me how different this is versus what you would say to the client. Spits it out and he's like, oh my God, this is exactly what I would say to the client. I don't know if his job is necessarily in danger immediately, but I do know everybody who would be getting his job in 5 years, 10 years is probably going to be radically different than it is right now.
I've had in the last 3 days, two separate inquiries for companies wanting advice on AI and legal. Two separate companies looking to get into the space, wanting to speak to somebody to explain how these things work and how they do that. And what's happening is bigger firms are starting to look at this because they look at how to cut their costs and they're going to start leveraging AI because you're going to say like, okay, do we need three paralegals? Do we need one paralegal? You know, and then for researchers and all these things, you're going to see at first that level. And it's already happened. You know, there's already, I talked to the son of the guy who was the one that filed the ChatGPT filing with the court that was clearly written by ChatGPT and got in trouble for that.
Really?
Yeah, I was randomly. Yeah, it was my dad. I told him about this and like, he didn't understand. And so he just used it to do it and send it. And now I see that cited everywhere. Like, well, these people do like one. Nobody told him to do that. He did it. And yes, there are going to be lazy lawyers and people who are going to not understand stuff to do that all the time. But there is a ton, way more stuff than you get. Diligent people will do it. Like, do my first draft, then I will read it and do that. So that is the one of the things we don't understand. We don't think about too, is what's, we don't really know how widespread what ChatGPT or how these AI tools are right now, because there are companies that might buy licenses to go have seat license to have every bit of access to it. But you don't know if the people working for you are already using it. I know of a major tech company, one of the biggest tech companies on the planet, had a no ChatGPT policy. Internally, everybody was using it on iPads to go use ChatGPT to help them do their work. And that was like a significant thing to show you how much utility people. And again, people can go like, it's used. It's like, cool. Tell everybody they're wrong. You know, tell everybody they're wrong. You know, we're all cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. At a certain point, 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong, right?
Yeah.
Like there's a reality to rubber meets the road on this. That just is something that we have not seen in a very, very, very long time. And in so many different ways.
There's that you have to stop and say, oh wait, am I wrong? And again, it's not to say it can do everything well and whatnot, et cetera. And I see this all the time, even on tech sites, Hacker News, you'll see this sketch. Like I asked a question, it gave me a wrong one. It's all hype. It's like, okay, why is everybody, are you smarter than everybody? Are you typing this from your Gulfstream jet as you go to your island highway in the Caribbean?
Because
you smarter than, you figured everything out and everybody else has, or maybe there's utility there. And
maybe it's user error. And there indeed is something. I mean, I don't know. To me, I wouldn't really take seriously anybody who dismisses the technology out of hand.
Yeah.
Short of us finding out that all GPTs are actually just a gigantic farm in India and somewhere deep into mainland China where people are typing things back. I think this is real and it's here to stay and it's scalable.
Somebody made that claim very early on with ChatGPT. Somebody said they were an AI researcher, was very confused. They did not know the state of the AI, and they insisted there had to be people there writing the responses because they just couldn't fathom that it could do that. And because it can be frightening, but And the other side of it too is that you're going to see a lot of dumb investments and stuff. I strongly tried to advise a firm about 2 years ago because they looked at a company and they were so eager to get in on the space. And I'm like, I couldn't speak directly about the company they were talking about, but I'm trying to like draw a circle and say, I wouldn't invest in a firm that had, you know, a non-technical founder leading the company, you know, that was, you know, basically rebranding existing stuff as their own, you know, and trying to $100 billion later, you know, and it's floundering and, and it's even the investors.
There was a YouTube video that got served to me yesterday that I think was good informationally, but you know, the thing that got you in the door is the AI bubble already popping?
Yeah.
And it demonstrated a couple different, but it was more of what you were talking. And I think that the video itself made the point that this is not about the technology not being real. This is about bad businesses and bad leadership and people overpromising on things that they can't deliver and then realizing that they're ass over tea kettles and they owe people hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, the two biggest, I'm not going to name names right now, but the two biggest implosions that have been happening had the same thing. They were non-technical founders who saw dollar signs, and some of them had what looked like a technical degree and it looked like they didn't really have it. And also had reputations being bad managers, you know, and it was just, it's every company that has folded right now, I would have told you 2 years ago, yeah, they're going to have a problem because of this. But investors get into hype cycles. They don't want to believe that. They want to say, no, we think this is going to be true. And then there was a New York Times article written about like, hey, you know, are these companies going to make it and whatever? And they made the case that like stability AI was in the strongest position because image generation was cheap. And it's like, okay, stability AI has been laying off people. Imad had to leave, non-technical founder, and their revenue, the rumors are they can't even pay their server bills. I don't know that that's true, but that's just like, that's not a good sign. And I can run these open source models on my computer and do image generation. And it's like, it's a horrible. And I'm like, who is their source for the New York Times? The investors? Cause it was baffling to me.
Maybe it was somebody who made a very compelling picture.
Yeah.
And sent it to the New York Times.
Yeah.
You know, it's like profit go up.
Yeah. See,
all right. Andrew, where can people read your article that we have been discussing?
It's on, if you go to reason.com and you click on magazine, it's the June issue of Reason. So it's available in print, but it's online for free to read if you like.
And you mentioned the fact that you have talked to a bunch of people who are interested in AI stuff. If there is a business that wants to reach out, is there a place where they can do that?
Just send me an email. Aiming@gmail.com. I'm happy to hop on the phone with anybody and just give them advice. So
there we
go. I'll give you my Calendly.
Ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only Andrew Main. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Justin.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. If you'd like to email the show, it is theyoungamerican@gmail.com. You want to find clips of this show? TikTok is Justin R. Young. Instagram is Justin R. Young. YouTube is Politics, Politics, Politics. Twitter is Justin R. Young. And you can share the audio version of this podcast, px3podcast.com. Share it with your friends, your family, your clergy. We are, of course, an independent media operation. We fund everything farm to table. If you would like to tip the staff, you can. PayPal.me/payjury. Venmo is Justin-Young-20. Cash App is PX3Cash. And you can send me anything you'd like in the mail. P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Of course, you can always get our bonus content at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcasting schedule. And our $10 tier gets you that, plus your name read at the end of the show, like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Sugar Brady, Sam, John, Niemeister, Edwin, Evoke Gloria Young for King of the New World Order, Brian, Edison, Jeremy, A Dog Named Checkers, Sarah Jeannie, Matthew, Dr. G, Shad, Chill, Dustin, Brad, D-Laser, Nick, just another pilot, middle-aged Mike, Utah, Jimmy, Montana, the Gen, Alo, D-Really, Andrew, Lisa, Fat Tony's PJs from New York, Devon, the CFP, Gloria, Grayzone, Peepaw, Jay, Neil, John, DP for Bungo, Neil is Nerdiness, Charles, Audrey, Stole Adler, Spot, Darren, Idris Arslanian, Berkeley, Steven, Nomadic, Terran, Molly's Delightful Demeanor, Adam, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, Bluefront, and the Lenina, and you, if you head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Very good timing, because we've had this interview booked for weeks, but we are going to have somebody from the libertarian-aligned Free State movement on the show this Wednesday coming up. I wonder what we'll talk about. But till then, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying, some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics, but this is the only show that dares discuss. Oh, three.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.